So I'm reading this book, My Fair Junkie by Amy Dresner, and the whole book is like her on her journey with being a drug addict and then getting sober. So I get to the end of the book. I'm at the like second to last chapter, and she hears about this guy, Nathaniel, who does breath work with addicts. So she goes to this breath work guy and she has this amazing experience. She's like laying on the table. She thinks that it's stupid. And then all of a sudden she's like sobbing. Then even in the acknowledgments after the book, she thanks him. And she says to my breathwork guy, Nathaniel, who's seen me cry more than a decade's worth of therapists and boyfriends combined. And I was just like, whoa, like she just is breathing and she's like doing all this crying and it's very therapeutic. And but anyway, I'm reading it and I'm like, this is not the first time I have read this experience in a memoir. A very similar thing happened in Love Warrior by Glennon Doyle. The very end of the book, like the one of the last chapters, she literally just Googles breathwork in, you know, wherever she lived in Florida. And she goes to a breathwork like class. There's other people in the class. It feels very much like similar to like a meditation or a yoga, but you're just like laying on the floor and you're being guided through some breathing techniques. And she had this experience where she kind of has like an out of body moment. And she writes in her book on page 215, "What happens next lasts for one moment and forever. I feel myself begin to float up and out of the room into a night sky filled with stars." And then a little bit later on, she writes, "For the first time in my life, I feel the utter absence of fear. I am completely comfortable. I am at peace." Like, what? Like, these two women writing their stories, getting to the end of the book, and having this like crazy experience working with breathwork. So I Googled breathwork near me. And yesterday, I did it. I was just a one-on-one with this woman who does breath work and I had an experience. And so I'm going to tell you about it. This was huge. I like was reading the book and I was like, I have to do this. Glennon Doyle did it and Amy Dresner did it. And you know, they put it at the end of their books. This is like life-changing thing. So I got to go. So I find this woman, I read her bio online and I'm like crying as I'm reading her bio. She wrote about how she was kind of just like living life on autopilot. And then she got in this really horrific car accident. Her car flipped over and everything. And she was okay, but it was like a turning point for her. And she's been on this journey. And she wrote something about authenticity. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm on my journey to authenticity too. And now she guides people through this breathwork thing. So I go in and I'm just sure that I'm going to cry when I even start talking to her. And so of course I do. I'm always on the verge of tears. And this is kind of like part of the reason why I wanted to do it is because I feel like I'm always holding in my emotions. Because of that, whenever something big is happening inside for me, I immediately, like I cannot stop myself from crying. So I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm crying right now. But then I lock it back up. So it's a me trying not to cry, but then like the tears come out and then me, you know, catching my breath and I'm being okay. But I'm never really letting myself do it. And I've talked to Sam about it and I've talked to myself about it, how I just want to let myself cry. But even though I want to cry, I can't. So I go in and she's so warm and welcoming. She just asked me what brings me in. And I'm like, well, that feels like a loaded question. And so I tell her the short answer about the books, how I've just like read this book. And then these two authors in their memoirs talked about doing it. And so I was like, I'm going to try it. But then I told her the long version. And then of course I just start crying. And I tell her about how I read her profile and how it moved me and how I've been on my own journey to authenticity and how through my journey to authenticity, I'm having more hard conversations with people. And when I have hard conversations with people, I get very emotional and it's really hard. And I don't know what that has to do necessarily with coming to her, but I just feel like if I do this breathing thing, I kind of feel like it's just an opportunity for me to cry without anybody judging me and actually encouraging me to. So I tell her I have no expectations, but I guess that's kind of a lie because I do. I'm like, I'm expecting to cry and I'm expecting to have like a life-changing moment. No pressure. So the gist of it is, I'm there for, I guess, a little bit less than an hour. I lay down on this mat and she puts on some music and then she's talking sometimes. And then sometimes I'm just in my head, you know, and the constant thing going on in my head is like, this isn't going to work. Nothing's going to happen. I'm just going to lay here and breathe. What a waste of my time. What a waste of money. So I'm like battling that at the same time. So I'm going through this and I'll just tell you there's two things that happened that feel big. One was very big. It probably happened like closer to the end, like maybe 40 minutes in or 30 minutes in. I have to back up a little bit to tell you guys about this. Some of you might know that in 2021, so we're talking, so 3 years ago, I did this online workshop. It was for it was David Prill and Tiago Forte's like annual review, like this super like, productive thing where you reflect on the year. But they had this guest speaker come in and she was there to guide us all through a visualization. And I thought it was such a joke. And then it ended up being this amazing experience where I closed my eyes and she told us to imagine our future Y selves. And in this vision that I had that was very clear, I saw my future Y self. And the thing that I noticed about her, one of the things I noticed about her was that she was not drinking and that she was sober. And I knew just by looking at her, she had a glass in her hand with it looked like a cocktail, but it was, I knew that it was water. And this was a very, this really hit me and made me start crying because I was like, oh my God, one, does this mean that I'm not going to drink anymore? And two, it was like really scary. Like, oh my God, like, I've been trying to cut back, but I can't imagine like completely cutting it out and like never drinking. And in the vision, she did not speak to me. She just kind of smiled and sat next to me and held my hand. So I'm laying on the mat and I hear the woman, her name was, I guess I shouldn't say her name. She says something about if you're visualizing something, and her saying the word visualize, I immediately thought of my future wise self. And I thought of that visualization and it was like to go to your happy place. So I went there and it's just in my backyard with the pool and my husband and kids in the background. Like I hear laughter and Sam's grilling, and then my future wise self is there. And I see her and she turns to me with a big smile on her face and she says, "Hey." And I was so taken aback that she was speaking that I just started sobbing. And she says, "You're getting closer." And she was so happy and happy for me to be there and happy to see me. And it was just awesome. It just felt really good because I am getting closer. I'm getting closer to the person that I want to be. And so that was just, it was really nice. And then at the very end, something that I struggle with and that I've been working on and getting better on is how I talk to myself, being kinder to myself and not like berating myself. And earlier that day, yesterday, I had one of my moments, temper tantrums, where I was berating myself because of something stupid that I had done. I haven't done that in a long time, but man, I was just like, it was so dumb. I'm not even gonna tell the story. Fine, I'll tell the story. I ordered these sneakers, new shoes. I've had the same shoes for like 8 years and my feet have grown and they're too small for my feet and they're dirty and I just need a new shoe. So I order these shoes. I'm really excited about them. They come in. I check on the receipt that the size is right and I put them on my feet and I take off the tags and I lace them up. I'm like, great, these fit. And then I go for a walk around the block with my daughter and I come back and they like felt it like tiny bit big. And so then I like compare them to my old shoes and I'm like, oh my God, these look enormous. And then I finally like actually check the size on the shoe and they're a full size bigger than what I ordered. And I just lose it. I totally lose it because Sam and I are going to New York for this weekend and I really wanted to have my new shoes. And I was just really mad at myself, even though once I was able to calm down, I realized that, well, they sent me the wrong shoe size. It wasn't my fault. But I was mad at myself that I just put them on and took off the tags and walked around the block in them and didn't even realize that they didn't fit my feet. Like I just felt really dumb for that. So anyway, I had that experience earlier in the day, and tangentially, parenting is really hard, as I tell you all the time. And something that Sam and I have been learning for how to talk to George is to create boundaries, which is something that I'm learning for myself in general in life. And so, for example, we've changed the way that we talk to George for certain things. So let's say, for example, he hits his sister. Well, instead of saying, "Don't hit your sister," we say, "I'm not going to let you hit your sister," and then, you know, move him away from her. Or if he bites the furniture, "I'm not going to let you bite the furniture," and then move him away. And suddenly I just said to myself, "I'm not going to let you hurt her." And so I felt like in that moment, I was creating a boundary with myself. Like my future wise self was saying, "I'm not going to let you," like my old self, "hurt her, hurt me anymore." And then I got very emotional hearing myself say that to myself, because it felt like I was trying to protect myself. And how I'm going to follow through on that, I don't know. Maybe just the fact that I said it, that I'm not going to let you hurt her, because I was just so mean to myself, and I can be very mean to myself. And so then I, you know, was crying a little bit again because of that. So yeah, I did it. And the actual breathing didn't really feel like anything special. Mostly it was just like deep breaths in and out. And then a couple of times we would do this like short bursts out where you're just like, kind of like at whatever pace it works for you. It was cool. I don't know if this is something that like I'm going to like do again, or it's certainly not going to be a regular thing, but I'm really glad I did it. I'm really glad I got to see my future myself. And when I do these, you know, deep dives on these books and talk about what I've learned, sometimes it has nothing to do with the writing, and it has to do with the story. And so in this case, this book really moved me to do something, to take action and move more towards my authentic self. So let's get into some actual things I learned from the writing. There was a couple things that quick things that I loved. And then there's a lot of things that I would change. The reason I would change it is because of what I learned from Jeanette Walls in The Glass Castle to not write your feelings and your thoughts. And what I'm realizing is that, and I'm so curious to know how this sits with you guys, but I think that this has to do with creating your own voice. And it's like, this is clearly something that is really important to me now, that with my writing, I just like, there's no looking back. I can't go back to that way of constantly writing my thoughts and my feelings. But I wonder if other people think differently. And so it's just a stylistic choice. But before we get to that, let me just tell you these two things that I loved. One is character intros. Okay. I never really talk about like when you introduce a person in a book, but she had the best character intro that I've read so far. So let me just read it to you and then we can talk about it. On page 6, she introduces her friend Linda. She writes, "Linda is a bipolar bisexual from Nebraska. She's one of those haut hippies who only wears cashmere and the highest grade designer leather, loves animals almost violently, and has a house stocked full of crystals and natural cleaning products. She wears $300 perfume and $2,000 boots, but won't shower for days." So something that stood out to me here is how long it was. She, you know, you think you just want to like move on, like get to the story. What are we going to say about Linda? But I felt like the longer it was, the more detailed it was, the more funny it was. And I was very engaged with this entire thing. So the first thing that stood out to me was that she described her as a bipolar bisexual. That was just really a fun thing to see next to each other. Bipolar bisexual. Obviously, you've got the repetition of bi in both of those words. And then she didn't just say that she only wears, you know, expensive clothes. She said she only wears cashmeres and the highest grade designer leather. Like, I didn't even know that leather was categorized in grades. So, you know, she takes it to that next level. This made me laugh. Loves animals almost violently. You know, those people who just want to like, you know, eat their animals. So that was funny. And then she gets really specific here. You know, it's not expensive perfume. It's $300 perfume and $2,000 boots. Like these are very specific items with actual prices. And then she says she won't shower for days. Like I have a very good idea now of in my head of who this Linda is just by a good character intro. So I think when I am introducing people, it's really fun to go deep on these details and make it funny. And speaking of making things funny, I've decided that I am going to create a new rule about parentheticals. Parentheticals, if you're going to use a parenthetical, it should only be hilarious. And so she had one that I want to read to you. On page 68, she writes, "Driving up the I-5 from Los Angeles in my 67 navy blue Thunderbird with the Red Hot Chili Peppers blasting, parenthetical, fuck you, it was 1993, they were very cool then, end parenthetical, I was trying desperately to convince myself that I was on the precipice of a life epiphany." So when I read this parenthetical, I laughed out loud. She's got the Red Hot Chili Peppers blasting, and she feels like that people are immediately going to judge her, and she says, fuck you, it was 1993, they were very cool then. That's very funny. So I was writing my newsletter this week, and I wrote a parenthetical in, and the sentence was talking about a physical therapist who was talking to me about what we were going to do, and he said, we're going to poke the bear. And then in parentheticals, I wrote, he said this so many times, it became comical. And I read that, and I'm like, well, that is a boring parenthetical, right? It's like, for me, it's true. It's very true. He said poke the bear so many times that it was funny. But it's not a very funny parenthetical to write. So I had to delete it. I just took it out because it was funny to me, but it wasn't funny on the page. So if I'm going to include a parenthetical, I think it should, you know, people are drinking their water and it's going to make them spit out whatever they're drinking. Like, that's what a parenthetical should be. Okay, I want to read the opening lines of the book to you because I thought they were good, but I couldn't help myself. I just like wanted to change them a little bit. I just thought they could be a little bit better. So let me read this beginning to you. It's maybe 12:30 at night. I am high on OxyContin. My husband Clay and I are in our coldly decorated luxury condo, fighting viciously after a particularly tense and overpriced Christmas dinner with my mother at the Peninsula Hotel. So this is a really good scene for her to start with because she's about to pull a knife on her husband and she gets arrested. So it's like, you know, a low point, as we've talked about in the past, starting with action and a low point. Now, the actual first sentence leaves something to be desired. It's maybe 12:30 at night. Okay, that did not grab me, but then the next line did grab me. I am high on OxyContin. Okay, now this is interesting. Now, the thing that really stood out to me, and maybe it's just because I'm obsessed with Christmas, but she says, an overpriced Christmas dinner with my mother at the Peninsula Hotel. So the fact that she's high on Christmas, just, I thought that was such a way to grab the reader. So if I were to rewrite this first line, I might write, it's Christmas night and I'm high on OxyContin. You know, it's a holiday with the family and you're high on OxyContin, like what the F? I just felt like that would grab me more. And then I couldn't figure out how to rewrite this next part, but you know, she says that her husband and her are fighting viciously in their coldly decorated luxury condo. And I like that you've got the coldly and condo alliteration there. And I'm trying to imagine it, but like, I can't really because she's not giving me more details. Like, I want to see the condo more. So like, what does it mean to have a coldly decorated luxury condo? Like, is there some kind of like weird modern black and white art on the wall? Is it all white furniture? Like, what does it look like to have a coldly decorated luxury condo? Like, I just wanted some more details there. And then instead of saying like a Christmas dinner, if we talk about Christmas in the first line, saying it's Christmas night, you know, what was for dinner at the Peninsula Hotel? What were they eating? Were they eating turkey or roast beef or, I don't know, Christmas fruitcake? Like, what? I thought that it might be more interesting to bring those details a little bit more to life so we could just see more of what was happening. Okay, so this was the next part. This is it. I just want to talk to you about some things that I would cut, but there's like a lot of things because I think the more that you can see this, the more you can understand why I think it's important. Her dialogue in this book is really fucking good. It's really powerful. It's shocking. There are many times where I just wanted her to give us the dialogue without her commentary. And I felt like her commentary took away from these incredible moments. So here's the first example. On page two, it's right after she pulled the knife on her husband and he calls the cops. She is about to get arrested. So she writes, "Moments later, I am handcuffed. The handcuffs are tight and cold around my wrists. You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against..." Yeah, Law and Order is my favorite show. I know the fucking drill, I say. "The Valium is starting to kick in and it's making me mouthy." So here, this line, yeah, Law and Order is my favorite show. I know the fucking drill, I say, is so fucking funny. And she already told us, like, paragraphs earlier that she popped all these pills of Valium. So for her to say the Valium is starting to kick in and it's making me mouthy, well, she's telling us what we already know. Like, you're cursing at a cop and you just told us you took the drug. So why are you telling us again that it's kicking in? Like, we understand how drugs work and it's making you mouthy. Well, clearly it's making you mouthy. So I just thought this would have been so much more powerful if she just ended it with, "I know the fucking drill." Like, that would have been so funny. Period. End. Move on. In chapter two, now she is in apology mode with her husband, Clay. And she writes, "I apologize profusely with pleading eyes, wrapping my legs around him. Amy, don't. Oh God, you hate me," I mutter and start crying. "Don't fucking cry. This is what you always do. You do something shitty and crazy and then you cry and make it about you." He's absolutely right. I start fidgeting with the long shag rug, ashamed. "You're abusive. You really need help," he says. "I was high." So this line, "He's absolutely right. I start fidgeting with the long shag rug, ashamed. I just don't need it." And it's just pulling me out of the moment and it's not letting me feel these feelings that I want to feel for her or about her. Because I believe Clay. I believe that he says, "You do something shitty and crazy and then you cry and make it about you." I don't need her to say he's absolutely right. I'm already getting that. She just pulled a knife on the guy. And, you know, for her to say that she's ashamed, I don't need her to tell me that. And I think what I've decided is that I am never going to write the word ashamed in my book. I was ashamed. It feels so boring and it feels so cliche. And maybe now I'm just starting to feel like saying your feelings feels cliche. Because when you tell me that you're ashamed, I feel less feelings. Like, I don't want to ever be told that someone was ashamed, unless maybe it's like a direct quote. So either show it or just leave it alone and let the reader feel what they're feeling. And so here's another example where she actually talks about shame. In chapter 20 on page 153, so here's what's happening. This Russian doctor refuses to take her as a patient and is like not... giving her the proper care that she needs. And so Amy's friend comes with her who speaks Russian and is talking to her. And she says, "My friend takes off her sunglasses and in Russian tells her that doctors should work not just with their heads, but also with their hearts, and that she is a heartless monster. The doctor looks back at her in quiet shame." And I'm just like, well, first of all, you don't really know. Like, if you tell us that somebody looks like they're ashamed, but you can't tell us what they were feeling or what they were thinking. So I just don't like to put that on another person, that they looked like they were ashamed. Secondly, the friend telling the doctor to her face that she's a heartless monster is so fucking good. Like, we don't even need the doctor's reaction because the doctor didn't even really have a reaction except for a look. So to just say, tells her that doctors should work not just with their heads, but also with their hearts, and that she's a heartless monster, like, that's a great place to end it. Okay, one more with shame, just so that you guys really, I want you to know this, okay? On page 154, and we're still with the same story, she writes, "Later, I call my sponsor, JW, to complain, and I get my ass handed to me for my lack of restraint of pen and tongue. You might be the only version of the big book she ever comes across. I don't think calling her a fucking cunt is going to change her mind or her behavior." Boom. You can hear the cloak of shame fall over me. "And maybe, just maybe, this was a blessing, because she would not be able to give you the kind of care you need or want. Double punch to the gut, I drop." So these lines from her sponsor were so good. He is putting her in her place. And I actually don't even think she needs to say, I get my ass handed to me. She just could say, I call my sponsor Jay to complain. And he says, you might be the only version of the big book she ever comes across. I don't think calling her a fucking cunt is going to change her mind or behavior. And maybe, just maybe, this was a blessing because she would not be able to give you the kind of care you need or want. That's it. I don't need to hear like, boom, you can hear the cloak of shame fall over me and double bunch to the gut I drop. It's just like all these times that she's commenting with her feelings and her thoughts is pulling me out of the powerful thing that is being said. If I didn't have her commentary here, let me tell you how I would feel. I would feel a little squirmy in my seat reading this, like, oh, she fucked up. But as soon as she adds these comments about feeling ashamed, it feels like now as the reader, I have to feel bad for her now, and it's taking away from the moment that I was feeling. Okay, let's go back to the beginning in that first scene with her husband when they're fighting after, now she's like apologizing after she pulled the knife on him. And she writes, it's always my fault, right? I rage. All my fault. You're fucking allergic to apologizing. You can never take any bit of responsibility. Responsibility, he says, you lie in bed all day while I go to work. And sure, maybe you go and tell some dick jokes at night. For how much money? Oh yeah, none. So don't tell me about responsibility, princess. Contempt drips from his every word. So this last line, contempt drips from his every word. I don't need it. I already feel the contempt when he says, so don't tell me about responsibility, princess. Like he, by what he says, which again, her dialogue is so good. I just don't need her to tell me what he's feeling. And it just doesn't feel as strong anymore. Telling me how someone feels dilutes my feelings about it. And by the way, in case you didn't pick up there, he says, you go tell some dick jokes at night. I forgot to mention that she was a stand-up comedian for a while. So that's why he's saying that. Okay, she does this thing where she did it multiple times throughout the book where, well, I'll just read this example and then I'll show you. So on page 44, she writes, as he drives me back to sober living, I vomit relentlessly. Yet instead of thinking I should not have drank, I think I should have just done coke. Welcome to the mind of an addict. Okay, so this last line, I just did not need it. Welcome to the mind of an addict. This line before it was so good. Yet instead of thinking I should not have drank, I think I should have just done coke. Like what the fuck kind of crazy person who is vomiting relentlessly thinks, ugh, I should have just done coke. Like it's so good on its own. And then 3 pages later, she writes, there's a sign by the sink that reads, do not leave dishes in the sink. Your mama doesn't live here. Funny. Welcome to living with 5 men. So she just said, welcome to the mind of an addict. And now she's saying, welcome to living with 5 men. You know, it's supposed to be like funny, but the lines before the commentary are so good to end on. Do not leave dishes in the sink. Your mama doesn't live here. That's it. It is funny. But when you write funny, welcome to living with 5 men, it's not as funny anymore. And then one more. She writes on page 162, they released me. I couldn't believe it. I had tried to kill myself, but in the UK, there was no mandatory 72-hour hold. And unlike doctors in the US, they didn't feel bad for me, weren't interested in analyzing how I felt. Honestly, they just made me feel like an asshole for what I'd done. Welcome to the NHS. I still don't know what the NHS was. She explained it earlier in the book and I couldn't find it. But why welcome to the NHS? Honestly, they just made me feel like an asshole for what I'd done. That's funny. She tried to kill herself and they made her feel like an asshole for trying to kill herself. And she's talking about the differences between the UK and the US. Like, it's funny. Okay. Okay, here's one where it feels like a cliche. And she's doing community service. She has to do it. She's been sentenced to do community service after the whole thing with pulling the knife on her husband. And there's this woman in the streets who's... you know, probably high or something. And on page 67, she writes, she starts to ramble on about how she can feel people meditate. I just smile and laugh and pretend to understand. Then she gently touches my arm and prances off. My heart breaks a little. So this last line I did not need. My heart breaks a little. And also my heart breaks a little feels so cliche. If she didn't write my heart breaks a little, it would end with this. I just smile and laugh and pretend to understand. Then she gently touches my arm and prances off. Something happens for me in that moment where I feel my heart you know, do the thing that she's kind of trying to tell me in the next sentence, which is break a little, like, oh, this woman who's high and messed up and she prances off. And now I'm left with these feelings about this woman and what's going on in her life and what she's doing. But when she says my heart breaks a little, it takes me out of my own feelings. And now I don't feel them at all. Okay, so here's another example where the dialogue is so good and then we don't, and then she wants to tell instead of just show. So on page 150, she's having an argument with her dad. And he says, "What is your truth, Ames? Just anything outrageous? Shocking everybody? I think that saying the thing that everybody is thinking and nobody dares says is revolutionary," I said. "I don't edit myself for fear of what other people think. That takes courage. You know, George Orwell said, in a time of universal deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act." "Uh-huh. But you don't even write anything down, Ames. You just lose a lot of friends. You fucking burn bridges while you're still on them. And AA is not a stage for you to do your act. You even told me that they think you're fucking crazy." "I don't deny that I have an impulse control problem. Cut me some slack, will you? I just cracked my head open and I'm newly sober again." My composure was starting to go. My eyes began to well up. I was going to lose it, and it was not going to be pretty. I knew there was truth to what he was saying. His delivery, however, left something to be desired. No surprise, we always served it up to each other with savage directness. Okay, so the dialogue was amazing, again, as usual. But then this whole section at the end where she's saying my composure was starting to go, my eyes began to well up, again, another cliche kind of phrase. I was going to lose it. And then she wants us to know through these lines that her and her dad have this way of being savagely direct with each other. So if that's what you want to tell us, don't tell us, show us. And the way to show us is to write about that one time you were arguing about this other thing and you said this and then he said that. And then that would show us how you guys are savagely direct with each other. So it's an opportunity to show and not tell. And if you can't show, then you just don't write it at all, I think. I think that's my easy solution is like, if I can't figure out how to show it, then I just leave it out. So like, I think I'm trying to like think about this in my life. So it's like, whenever I am describing a person, so like, let's say I'm describing myself and I want to say like, God, I need to be in control of everything. So instead of writing like, I need to be in control of everything, it's like, well, when I go to the grocery store, I can't even let somebody else bag my groceries because they don't do it right. Like, that's showing you an example of me needing to be in control. So thinking of more examples in my life, maybe even creating a note in my phone. Okay, I identify as being in control, needing to be in control. Let me figure, what are some ways that I'm in control? And doing this with like every descriptive word, like any way that I think that I am, what are examples? Okay, this is the last one. And then I'm going to wrap things up. So on page 155, this is continuing that story where the doctors wouldn't take her because she was a drug addict, or she was a drug addict before and now she's sober, but still these doctors like would not accept her as a patient. So on page 155, she writes, "She didn't want any more alcoholic patients," I explained. "How long are you sober?" she inquired. "Over 2 years," I said. "Yes, well, I'm not taking any patients right now. I'm sorry." Uh-huh. And the hunt for a doctor with a heart goes on. So again, I feel like right here, I am being asked as the reader to feel bad for her. And then it doesn't make me feel bad for her at all. If she just ended with, "Yes, well, I'm not taking any more patients right now. I'm sorry." I would have been like, fucking asshole, bitch, doctor, what the F? And I would be upset for her. And I would feel angry too. I would feel feelings. But when she says, uh-huh, and the hunt for a doctor with a heart goes on, it completely washes that away. Okay, I know that was so many examples for this one thing that I wanted to talk about. I feel like there is probably a better way to explain this. And the reason I feel like there must be a better way to explain this is because I was very animated during this and I was using my hands a lot, even though you can't see me. And I know when I'm doing that, it's like I'm trying to explain something so badly because I want you to understand. And when I'm doing that, it probably means that I'm not explaining it in the best way. I'm not sure. You can tell me. Okay, so that is a wrap on My Fair Junkie by Amy Dresner. Quick update on my book. I met with Michael Dean this week and I'm getting really excited about about things. So the big picture, I'm just going to reiterate, is that my book is about moving towards my authentic self and becoming my authentic self, the journey. And that's, you know, that's too big, but I think that is a universal, that's my universal kind of thing that I'm working towards. I mentioned last podcast episode that Michael thought that a good way in would be through my pseudonym, which I completely agree with. But something that we discovered in our call this week is that it's not just a journey to my authentic self. It's my journey to become a writer. And I don't know, a lot of you guys might not know this, but like I started writing online as Charlie Bleeker in 2020, but I started writing online as my real name in 2011, the day that I moved across the country from New Jersey to California with my then boyfriend and two of our other buddies. The timeline of my book up until this point, I felt like it's too big. I'm like, I'm basically writing from when I was born until now and I'm still going. So it's just like, it's too big, you know, and I'm not trying to write a life story. I need to have more constraints. And so what we figured out is that this book could start from the moment I started writing online to the moment that I become Charlie Bleeker or sometime around there. So now I've just shortened the time from 39 years, because that's how old I am, to from 2011 to 2020. So to 9 years. So start at 2011 and go to 2020. So that's really exciting. I just feel like we're lasering in, we're narrowing it down, we're figuring these things out. And it's really exciting. So just wanted to give you guys a quick update on that. The book that I'm reading now is called Life on Delay, Making Peace with a Stutter by John Hendrickson. It is riveting. I am ripping through it. I'm almost finished already. I have never known somebody well that has a stutter. I have never known anything really about stuttering. And so the book itself is very fascinating to learn about what it means to have a stutter and what it's like to have a stutter. And then it's also just a story that is so uplifting and heart-wrenching and gives you all the feelings. So I am really, really enjoying this. And I am excited to go through my notes and figure out which pieces I'm going to share with you. So that will be in 2 weeks. And I'll see you guys then.